This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Woody Allen began starring in his own movies like Love and Death, Annie Hall, and Manhattan, I, and lots of other people, assumed that he was like the characters he played, neurotic, insecure, obsessed with death and the meaning of life, or life's lack of meaning, and really funny. I wondered how the real Woody Allen compared to that film persona. I got the chance to talk to him this year, and we're going to hear an excerpt of that interview as part of our holiday week series of memorable interviews from 2009. We spoke after the release of his comedy Whatever Works, which stars Larry David as a misanthropic former Columbia University professor whose grim philosophy of life is, "Take what little pleasure you can get in this chamber of horrors." It's a philosophy expressed in several Woody Allen movies, like in this scene at the beginning of Annie Hall.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly.
Woody Allen, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's interesting.
Hi.
I'm wondering, why has this question framed several of your movies, that life is hard, life is full of pain, but life is short, so do what you can to get some pleasure?
Well, this is hardly an original thought with me. I mean, down through the ages, all the important writers and all the important philosophers have, in one form or another, come to the conclusion, the obvious conclusion, that, life is a terrible trial and very harsh and very full of suffering. And so whatever you can do with the stipulation that you don't hurt anybody without, you know, ruining a life here or there or causing any damage, there's nothing wrong with it.
So when we talk about making movies, does that give you pleasure? Like, what's the ratio of pleasure and pain in making a film?
Well, you know, it's a different kind of pain. It's, you see, making a movie is a great distraction from the real agonies of the world. It's an overwhelmingly, difficult thing to do. You've got to deal with actors and temperaments and scripts and second acts and third acts and camera work and costumes and sets and editing and music. And, you know, there's enough in that to keep you distracted almost all the time.
So may I ask, what are some of the real problems that making movies distracts you from?
Well, they distract me from the same problems that you face or that anyone faces. You know, the uncertainty of life and inevitability of aging and death of loved ones and mass killings and starvations and holocausts and not just the man-made carnage, but the existential position that you're in, you know, being in a world where you have no idea what's going on, why you're here, or what possible meaning your life can have, and the conclusion that you come to after a while, that there is really no meaning to it, and it's just a random, meaningless event. And these are pretty depressing thoughts. And if you spend much time thinking about them, not only can't you resolve them, but you sit frozen in your seat. You can't even get up to have your lunch.
Can you describe the neighborhood you grew up in? A lot of people imagine you growing up under the roller coaster in Coney Island, like your character in
Annie
Hall.
Right. People think that. No, I grew up in a very nice section of Brooklyn called Flatbush. And when I grew up there, it was a lovely, you know, it was a lovely section. I mean, there was ball field and playground. There were many, many, many movie houses within, you know, walking distance of, no matter where you were dropped, you'd be within walking distance of a couple of movie houses. And the blocks were tree-lined and safe, and you could go out and play ball all day long in the streets and schoolyards and it was a very nice neighborhood.
What was your parents' relationship like, and what did you make what did it make you think marriage was like?
Marriage for my parents was kind of like what it was in all the other neighboring houses and friends' houses. It was a long truce, is what it was. All the parents in the neighborhood, the men and women, they loved each other. There were people who were from the Depression, and so money was a big factor because nobody had any real money, and everybody had to work. But usually what would happen is the men and the women would – the guys would work all day, and they'd come home, and then on the weekends, the guys would – take bridge chairs out and play cards at a table, and the women would keep with the women. There was no sense that a guy was coming home on the weekend so he could take his wife and, leave the son with a babysitter or the daughter with a babysitter and check into a hotel and have a romantic weekend or do something romantic. There wasn't that. The guys would be, watching the ball game, or not watching so much, listening on the radio to the ball games together. They'd be playing poker or gin rummy or pinochle together. And that's how it was even when there was a dinner or something. The uncles and relatives would get together. And as soon as the dinner was over, the guys would be in the other room around a card table. And the women would be talking in their room about, and you didn't get a sense. You didn't come away with a sense of romantic passion. There wasn't much interpersonal charm to it.
I know that your movies aren't your life, but there's a scene in Annie Hall that is just like so funny, and I feel like I know these people. It's the dinner scene where you're at dinner with Diane Keaton, Annie Hall's family, and it's a much more kind of formal, quiet, polite, everybody eating slowly kind of setting. And you compare that in your mind with the family dinners you were used to, where people are like shoveling down the food and hollering at each other and everybody's aggravated and talking about who has diabetes. Was dinner like that at home?
Dinner was not really like that at home, no, because, I ate by myself at, 5:30, and my mother ate at 6:30 after she had made dinner for my sister and myself, and my father got home at 8:45, and he would have it. That stuff was made up and exaggerated for comic purposes.
How come you ate alone?
I ate alone because I like to eat alone, because I like, I like the solitude. I like to, eat and read a comic book or something. And
your parents let you do that without accusing you of being antisocial and turning your back on the family?
They were so happy that I wanted to eat alone. Because we always lived with aunts and uncles and things, and my mother would have a better time eating with her sister, or if my father got home in time and she was waiting for him, with him. But what am I going to talk about with my mother? I was 10 years old, or 9 or 11, and out in the streets all day playing stickball, and, we had nothing to talk about.
Now, you started in comedy by writing jokes, and you were writing for an older generation. What was the pay like? Did they pay you per joke or per joke that they used?
No, the pay was a lot. I mean, at the time, you think that my father and mother both had to work their whole life. My father drove a cab and was a bartender, was a bookmaker, and ran a pool room. My mother always worked in the flower market. They had to combine their salaries, and I started working, and their combined salaries would be, maybe less than $100 a week combined, and I started working, and the immediately I was making close to $200 a week. I was 17 years old and I was making that. And before long, I was making $1,500 a week. And in those days, this was the early 50s.
That was a lot of money.
The mid-50s. And it was more than my parents put together would make in ages. So the show business salaries, I always felt, were way out of whack with reality. Now, I haven't made a big protest over that over the years, you'll notice, but I always did feel that they were, you know, when you see what a school teacher gets and what some terrible comedian gets or some awful singer gets, you know, it's shocking.
Did you say your father worked in a pool room and he was a bookmaker?
Yeah, my father had a lot of jobs. He was always scuffling to make a living. He sold jewelry. He was a waiter. He was a bartender. He was a cab driver. He ran a pool room. He was a bookmaker for a while.
You must have met a lot of colorful characters through him, unless you were not welcome in that world.
I was young to have met the colorful characters, but he was always bringing home stolen merchandise. And, you know, that was fenced to him for no money at all. So he'd always be coming home with, you know, a fur coat for my mother or a typewriter or a tape recorder or this, you know, and pick this up for $2 and this up for $20. And, you know, there was a lot of that over the years, a lot of stuff bought. I remember that. You know, fence junk.
Were you supposed to keep that a secret, that it was fenced?
It was never expressed that way. It was, you know, it was that he came home with a bargain and,
right.
You know, that, and you say, my God, where did you get that, you know, electric typewriter for $1.25? It's brand new. And, you know, but you never knew that. And my father was an inveterate numbers player. There was not a day in his life that he didn't play the numbers. And whenever he won, you know, it was money for everybody. I mean, he just spread it around, you know, like Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners. I mean, he just, everybody, you know, it was such a pleasure if he came home and had hit his number. You know, my sister and I and my mother all knew we were going to be rewarded with an extravagant bonus.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Woody Allen, and his new movie is called Whatever Works, and it stars Larry David and Evan Rachel Wood. In the movie, Larry David is in his 50s, and Evan Rachel Wood is still in her teens when she shows up kind of homeless on his doorstep, and he decides, kind of against his will to, and against his better judgment, to take her in and give her a few meals and then to let her live there, and then they get married. So forgive me for asking this, because this is a little personal, but this was written before, like long before you married Sun Yi, but it means, let's be honest, that everyone's going to be looking for clues in this movie about your relationship with your wife. And and again, let's be honest, a lot of your fans were really kind of upset when you married the woman who was the adoptive daughter of your longtime lover. So I wonder if you thought about that kind of thing when you were making the movie, that people would just be like looking for clues about the older man, younger woman relationship and how
people,
that applies to you.
People do look for clues in my movies all the time.
For who you
in
really
all my
are.
Movies.
Uh-huh.
The people always look for clues in my movies, and they think based on my movies that they know me. And, of course, they don't know me. And there are some things you could have learned about me over the years, but not much, really. You know, I was never who anybody thought I was from when I started. When I first started as a comic in Greenwich Village, people thought that I was, at that time, some kind of a little beatnik and someone who, you know, was a kind of mousy intellectual. And, you know, none of these things were ever true. I never lived in the village. I always lived in a very nice neighborhood uptown in Manhattan. I was never intellectual. I was never interested in intellectual things. You know, when I explain to people, I'm the guy that you see in his T-shirt with a beer watching the baseball game at night at home on television, they find that hard to square with the characters that I've played in the movies. But in the movies, I'm just acting. But I've never been, you know, I was always a very athletic little boy, always a you know, never a loner or a loser, always the first one picked on any team.
You were the first one picked on any team?
Always.
See, I wouldn't have believed that.
I know. I was always
very
good athlete. I was interested even in playing professional baseball. I was, you know, won track medals. But nobody thinks of me that way. They think of me as, you know, some kind of little bookworm, because I have these big black glasses, black rimmed glasses, and they think of me as a bookworm and give me more credit for intellect than I have. And, I couldn't make it through college. I couldn't make it through my freshman year of college. And this was not because I was some artist or intellectual above it. I couldn't cut it. I mean, I wasn't... Couldn't get them out. I flunked out. I was thrown out of New York University in my first year there.
What did you fail?
Because I couldn't get the marks.
In what subjects?
I was a motion picture production major. I had to take regular subjects as well.
Don't tell me you failed
English,
picture classes.
And Spanish and subjects like that. I failed those subjects. And I didn't do well in motion picture production either.
Was this because you were busy writing jokes for other people?
I wasn't too busy. I was uninterested. I mean, I played ball. I was athletic. I played cards. I liked to... I wasn't interested in erudition and education. Those are not things that I was not brought up to be interested in. That and I wasn't interested. I didn't see it in my home, and this is long winded, but just to say that people have, are constantly looking for clues to me in my work, and seizing on things that are quite, quite unrepresentative of who I really am.
When people love somebody's art, they become very interested in the artist, and that leads them to be interested in the artist's personal life or what they can find out about it. And it's like some of your fans felt just upset and in some ways even betrayed, maybe, because of your marriage to Sun Yi, and they started reevaluating, well, do I see his films differently now? I think a lot of people went back and rewatched Manhattan or thought about Manhattan because it's the story of an older man and a younger woman, a middle-aged man and a teenager. Do you think it's fair or wrong to evaluate an artist's work by decisions they've made or what you think of decisions they've made in their personal life? Or do you think that that's...
I think you can evaluate an artist any way you choose to. You're free to evaluate an artist in any way that you want to, based on anything that makes you happy.
And do you care what people think of your personal life? Or is that just irrelevant to you?
Well, do you care? If I say I don't care, it sounds so cold and callous. But let me put it this way. How could you go through life, taking direction from the outside world? I mean, what kind of life would you have, if you made your decisions based on, the outside world and not what your inner dictates told you? You would have a very inauthentic life.
So you told us you didn't eat with your family. Do you eat when you were growing up that you ate alone because you liked to be alone with your comic book at dinner?
Yeah.
And your parents preferred the company of adults. Do you eat with your children now?
I eat with the children, yeah, but because they like our company, the generations are different. I'm much closer to my children than my parents were to me. You know, my kids and I and my wife, you know, talk about the same subjects, and you know, we're all friends. Now, I'm an older parent, but I'm still a parent in a younger generation than the generation that I grew up in, obviously. So, you know, I do eat with my children, and we like it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Woody Allen recorded in June. Our series of memorable interviews from 2009 will continue in the second half of the show and through the week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Tina Fey and I had an agreement that if Barack Obama won, I would speak for the show from now on. Welcome to Post-Racial America. I'm the face of Post-Racial America. Deal with it, Kate Blanchett.
That's Tracy Morgan accepting the Golden Globe on behalf of 30 Rock this year in his typically unpredictable way. He's earned his reputation as a wild card, and so has the character he plays on 30 Rock, Tracy Jordan. The character was created for Morgan by Tina Fey, the creator and star of the series. She worked with Morgan on Saturday Night Live, where he spent 7 years. On 30 Rock, Morgan plays the star of an NBC sketch comedy series who's always getting into trouble and saying and doing the wrong thing, clueless about why it's wrong. Tina Fey plays the head writer. I spoke with Tracy Morgan in October after the publication of his memoir, I Am the New Black. We're going to hear an excerpt as part of our series of memorable interviews from 2009. We started with a clip from the fall season's opener of 30 Rock. The head of the network, played by Alec Baldwin, has made it clear that in this economic hard time, the show has to reconnect with the real America. And he's told Tracy that he's lost touch with his roots and needs to reconnect with the common man. Back in the dressing room, Tracy talks about this with the two members of his entourage, Dotcom and Grizz.
I blame you and Dotcom. You two have built a protective shell around me like a hermit crab or mermaid booby. And now I've lost touch with the common man. Who's that?
This is Riley, the custodian. You said you wanted an ordinary person to reconnect with.
Oh, hey, guy, come on in. So, Riley, where are you from?
Brooklyn.
Right on, my brother. My dear friend Moby opened up a tea house in Park Slope. Does he know you? Hey, Riley, you ever lose your remote control?
Yeah.
And then your wife start getting all mad because the roof won't close and the bed that's in the shape of your face is getting rained on. I like you, Riley. Can I feel the rough skin on your hands?
Tracy Morgan, welcome to Fresh Air. Does that scene connect with anything from your life, that sense of having lost touch with your roots?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It still rains on me. From Tracy Jordan and Tracy Morgan are two different entities, okay? Tracy Morgan is not a part of Tracy Jordan's life. Tracy Jordan is a part of Tracy Morgan's life. But that's television. That's a figment of someone's imagination. You know, life smacks Tracy Morgan in the face. And I don't mean to talk in third party, but no, it doesn't stop raining when I come outside. No. Absolutely not. I'm very in touch.
You've worked closely with Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live and on 30 Rock. How did you start working together? Did you work together as a collaborative team on Saturday Night Live before 30 Rock?
No. On Saturday Night Live, I never really wrote. You know, I would let the writers cast me into the show. So my strength, and I put all my energies into performance. I just couldn't deal with the rejection, you know, getting your sketches cut. And it was hard for me. So I said, you know what? I'm going to focus all my energies on performance. I'll let them cast me in stuff. And when I cast me in stuff, I'll be the funniest thing in it.
Let's talk about growing up.
Right.
So you grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. Describe the neighborhood.
Well, it was rough. It was Bed-Stuy, do or die. You know, it was rough. It was deprivation. It was poverty. It was ghetto USA. It was what it was. But there was love. There was a lot of love, you know, but then crack came along and guns came along and, you know, it became an epidemic in America.
Your father fought in Vietnam and you say he fought for like four or five tours and he came home addicted to heroin and that kind of split up the family because your mother didn't want you around him when he was using.
Of course not. My mother loved my father. My mother tried to help my father, but when you're addicted to heroin, that's a very powerful addiction. And most people never survive it. And like many other young men that went over and served in Vietnam, a lot of them came back junkies.
I know, but
that's how heroin and all of these things took place in the 70s. It was a big boom on that. It was young kids over there just trying to get through the night.
When you were six or seven and you know, your father was freshly home and you were trying to get to know him, did you understand what it meant to have a habit? And here's what I'm even thinking, you know.
No,
like,
I was 6 years old.
I know, and kids are so afraid of needles, you know, of getting like
I was 6 years
vaccinations
old.
And shots. And here your
I
father
I knew my
is.
Daddy was sleepy all the time.
Uh-huh.
That's all I knew. But he was my daddy.
Right.
Kids don't see fault like that. Kids' minds ain't even that developed.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, like you write about how your father would have night terrors from post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, and that would make me cry because my daddy was scared and I knew that and I was a baby, but I seen it.
Yeah, but I figure that must have been really scary to see your father scared like that.
Oh, you don't know the half. People are really shocked about some of the things and revelations that are made in this book, but you don't even know the half. There are people still, I know people going through this every day. My childhood, yeah, sure, it wasn't a happy ending. I lost my daddy, and at some point I lost my mommy emotionally, but she had five kids.
Yeah, we write about how you left your mother's home in Brooklyn to live in your father's home in the Bronx when you were in high school.
I thought it was because I wanted to play football and she didn't want to let me.
And now
but
what
I
do
think
you think?
It was bigger than that. Now that I look back on it now, I think that I ran because if I would have stayed, I might have became a statistic like some of my other friends. I might have got caught up in the streets, and I might not be sitting here talking to you. So I did what I thought was best for me, and I ran, and I went to my father, who put me in a high school with a football team, and said, run, Trey, have fun. And by the time I really got to know him, I was still going through anger, because I was still angry. I was like any other inner-city child with a chip on his shoulder because his daddy and his mommy wasn't together.
And I should say, when you went to live with your father, he wasn't using anymore, right?
No, he had stopped maybe 10 years.
Yeah, I just wanted to make that clear.
But it was too late. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was too late. He wasn't using then. My father was he was down like four flat tires at that time, but I was angry. He was always in my life. My father was always there, taught me how to, took me fishing and all these things. But it's not like having daddy there.
You write that when you were in high school and living with your father sent you to two psychiatrists because you were so angry all the time.
Me, I was.
Did you understand then what was making you angry, and is your take on it now different?
I was 16, 17 years old. I just knew I was mad. And I might have been mad at him. I might have been mad at him because when I went to school, I was around my peers. I was the life of the party. I made them laugh and everything. But when I went home, it would just be like I was mad. Because now he's trying to tell me, and I felt like I had grew up already. By the time I was 11 years old, I was hanging out to 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Now I'm with you. Now you're telling me I have to be in by 8 o'clock and I have to eat 3 square meals and I have to study. What? It's too late for that.
Do you think you're still angry because you still sound a little bit angry?
No, I'm not angry. I'm just passionate. I don't see myself as angry, although other people see that. I just see myself as a short, dumpy guy with bad feet and I'm passionate.
Okay.
I'm a grown man now. I'm doing well off.
All right.
I really don't have anything, and my kids are fine. You know, my ex-wife is fine.
Good,
so.
Good.
But when I speak passionately. I do. It's not anger. I mean, that little 17-year-old boy, he's grown up. He's a man now. And when I was angry, when I was younger, I was in a cocoon. Now I'm a beautiful black butterfly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tracy Morgan, who now stars on 30 Rock. You probably also know him from Saturday Night Live. And he has a memoir now, which is called I Am the New Black. Mm-hmm. In reading your memoir, it seemed to me the most emotionally difficult part of what you were writing was writing about leaving your mother. That when you were in high school, you decided you didn't want to live with her anymore. You wanted to live with your father. And you just kind of left one day.
It was a terrible situation. It was a really terrible situation, and it wasn't my mother's fault. Something just went off in me. I wanted better for me. And I not only ran away, I came back a year later and got my little brother and my little sister.
And took them with you to your father's house.
Yeah. And, to see
and he got custody. He got legal custody. Which
that was really hard. That was the hardest day of my life. And I heard my mother cry. And it just broke me down. And I think about it now. I never meant to hurt my mother.
In the book you describe how you... Are you okay to keep going?
Yeah.
In the book, you describe how you and your mother never reconciled.
One day we will. Maybe one day she'll pick up this book.
I figure she
Maybe
would.
Maybe she'll read it.
Do you intend part of it to be a wife saying to her, let's talk?
When you talk to someone, they can either argue with you and just shut you off and walk out the room. When you talk to somebody on the phone, they can hang up on you. But when you write them a letter, they have to read that letter. You just have to read that letter. Me, I forgive my mother and I moved on. That's for my moving on. That's for me. My mother had to forgive herself. I understand, Mommy. That's all I'm saying is I understand. I understand what the position you was in and why you did what you did. I love my mother. My mother made sure her stubbornness, she made sure we was going to eat. She made sure we had Christmases. That was my mother. My father wasn't there for that.
You know, it's going to be odd for people hearing this. A lot of people say that when they see you being interviewed, that they never know, like, what's the real Tracy Morgan and what's, like, part performance. And right. And so people are always used to seeing you being comically over the top as yourself on television. Well, I'm not talking about 30 Rock or anything. I'm just talking about, like, when you're interviewed. And there's a famous thing that's all over YouTube where you're interviewed by a local TV
show. Well, you're the first person to ever interview me in retrospect.
Is that true?
Now you're seeing the other side.
Oh, okay.
Now you're seeing the other side because
it's just like
you was
completely,
interested.
It's like 180 degrees from the over-the-top comic side. It's like, whoa. It's like...
I love you for that, Terry. Uh-huh. I love you for that. Just caring. Just being interested. I love you just for that, you know? And I feel good.
Being that
but
emotional.
It's emotional. It's emotional for me. It is. And I got to be honest with thyself. I'm funny. I still turn the funny on. The funny bus is still sitting downstairs. Yeah, the funny bus. I got a whole truckload of funny downstairs.
Okay.
Stop.
I just think people are going to be kind of stunned, like, whoa, this is like not what I was expecting. It's like he's got his.
Well, you think they're going to say I had a meltdown on the air? And all that.
No, but people cry. No,
people
I know.
Have emotions.
No, I know. I know.
I feel.
I know.
Yeah, I feel.
So I want to get back to Saturday Night Live when you joined there. I'm going to quote something from the book. You say, I'm real life ghetto, and that's probably why they brought me into Saturday Night Live. But Saturday Night Live wasn't ready for that, not at first. I had my finger on the pulse of urban comedy, but when I brought my act to Saturday Night Live, they just felt bad for me. I want to play an excerpt of a sketch from Saturday Night Live that kind of satirized the differences between you and other members of the staff. So this is a sketch with Rachel Dratch, and you're co-hosting a talk show, and she describes it as a show inspired by actual conversations and interactions between Rachel Dratch and Tracy Morgan. So here it is.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Rachel.
I'm Tracy.
And today we'll be talking to a funny man and talk show host in his own right, Jon Stewart. But first, a segment called Catching Up, where Tracy and I catch up with what's going on in each other's lives. So, Tracy, what'd you do last night?
I just chilled out with the homeboys, you know what I'm saying? Busted down a couple of bottles of Cristal at the club. Drove around my baby blue Jaguar. Typical bad boy stuff.
Cool, cool.
What about you, Dratch? What you did last night?
I went to this Brazilian Brazilian restaurant on the Upper West Side with a couple Dartmouth friends. You should go. They have really good flan.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
So that's Rachel Dratch and my guest Tracy Morgan on Saturday Night Live. So was there like a culture gap similar to the one that we just heard in that sketch between you and Rachel Dratch or you and other members
Absolutely.
Of the show?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We celebrated the differences and where the places that we came from. Saturday Night Live was like a university for funny. And at that point, I realized that in order for me to do it, I had to put my guards down and let the writers see my flaws to make fun of them. And I learned how to do it. And that was my process. That became my process. Okay, what I'm doing, it may be too urban for this mainstream audience. So I let the young guys, the mainstream writers, do it. But I'll give them the stuff.
What do you mean you'll give
if
them
I
the
didn't
stuff?
Give you, if I didn't give 30 Rock writers stuff to write about, I mean, what? I'm a 40-year-old black man from the ghetto. You know what I mean? What does a young writer know, white writer know about that?
So what did you give them?
So it was all collaboration. I just started to collaborate, and I realized the gift of collaboration is more than the gift of competition.
How did you start collaborating with Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live?
Just being funny around her. And she go, and Tina Fey was basically the first one to go, wait a minute, this dude is funny, but you got to let him be him. You can't be afraid. Yeah, he's edgy. He's from the ghetto. But let's let him be him. And it worked.
So what did she write for you that you thought really worked?
She wrote me in The View.
Oh.
She wrote me in Judge Judy.
Star Jones.
All of these things. Yeah, Star Jones. She wrote all of that stuff.
One of the characters you did on Saturday Night Live was Maya Angelou, the poet and memoirist. And so I just want to play an excerpt of that sketch. It's on Weekend Update with Tina Fey at the desk. And you're wearing this, like, you know, graying wig with, like, large red glasses and lipstick and gold earrings and a right. kind of almost tie-dye orange-red top.
I remember.
Okay, so here you are as Maya Angelou introducing your Hallmark cards.
This month, Hallmark Cards will release a series of greeting cards written by poet Maya Angelou. Here now with a preview of her work is Maya Angelou. Wow.
Thanks, Tina. As always, you effervesce the sweet aroma of woman in full bloom.
Thank you. That's good, right?
Oh, yes. And now I shall read some of my Hallmark cards. I will begin with this one here. It's my favorite. I lay down in my grave and watch my children grow. Proud blooms above the weeds of death. I lay down in my grave, to die. Happy fifth birthday, grandson.
Wow, that was moving. It's a very moving sentiment.
It made my grandson cry for days. And look, there's a little slot to put money in.
Oh, see, that's perfect. Yeah.
This next one is my favorite. I see you brown skin, neat afro, full lips, a little goatee, a Malcolm, a Martin, Du Bois. Sunday service becomes sweeter when you are black, black like the night. Happy bar mitzvah, you little boobalack.
That's Tracy Morgan in a sketch from Saturday Night Live playing the poet Maya Angelou. So when Tina Fey told you that she had written a show around a character that she created for you, what did you think?
I knew it was going to be funny because everything else she had did for me was great. And I was like, Tina, I love Tina. I'll roll with Tina. But what we didn't know was how successful the show was going to be. I know I didn't see all of this coming, 14 Emmys and all of that stuff. Nobody sees all that. We just like put the work in and hope people love it.
Some of the stories in 30 Rock do connect to your life. Most famously, the ankle bracelet that you had to wear after getting arrested for driving under the influence. And it's a bracelet that basically sends an alarm to, mm-hmm. like, some kind of headquarters. If you drink, it can sense the fumes. So it's to prevent you from drinking for the...
Yeah, but it was hard for me, Terry. People always want to look into things. You know what I mean? They want to read into things more than what it is. So, you know, the thing I liked about Tina was that she didn't just... I had an ankle bracelet. Let's make fun of it. No, the ankle bracelet had been off for like a year. It had been off already. So she waited till the scars healed to make fun of it. She didn't do it while I was still hurting because she knew and she was sensitive to know that that bracelet was hurting me and my family. It was painful for me wearing that thing. You know, so she didn't just make fun of it right there. She would wait till the scar healed.
My guest is Tracy Morgan, the star of the NBC series 30 Rock and an alum of Saturday Night Live. Now, the title of your new book is I Am the New Black, and that is an allusion in part to a sketch that you did on Weekend Update in 2007 during the presidential campaign. I want to play that. This was in response. Geraldine Ferraro, during the campaign, had said about Obama, if he was a white man or a woman, he wouldn't be in this position. He happens to be very lucky to be who he is, implying that he was, like, really lucky to be black because it's making him more popular.
You know, that reminds me of what Lorne Michaels said to me when I first got to Saturday Night Live. And I thought people was, like, isolating me and all of that stuff. And Lorne Michaels called me in the room, and he simply said to me, Tracy, and this is coming from Norman, and this is why I love that man, like, he's my father. He said, Tracy, you're not here because you're black. You're here because you're funny. And that's all he had to say to me. My fangs came down and I began to feed.
So how did that change at Saturday Night Live when Lorne Michaels said to you, you're not here because you're black, you're here because you're funny?
It let me know. And I was there not because I was black. It let me know I'm here with Will Ferrell because I'm just as funny as him.
So did that...
Now go to work. I don't want to hear no excuses. I was looking for an excuse. And Lauren said, no.
An excuse for
I'm
what?
I'm not giving you that.
An excuse for what?
To fail, to bail out, to run. Again, like I did when I was a young kid with my mother, to run. And I got to stop running. I stopped running away, and I dealt with it.
Were you considering leaving the show? Did you feel like you were failing?
Yeah, there were times that you weren't in. Yeah.
Oh, wait, like...
I thought it was because I was black. They wasn't putting me in sketches. No, because I wasn't being funny. But I was making my adjustments. I was coming from a different world. I was coming from a world of black people and knowing how to make them laugh. And a lot of black entertainers, sometimes they search for the perfect audience. They stay in their comfort zone. And I was out of my comfort zone. And he said, make yourself comfortable. You're going to be here for a while, my man. You're very talented. And I believed him. Lorne Michaels is my customato, like Cuss was with Mike Tyson. Customato would come in Mike Tyson's room every night and tell him. And Mike knew. He was like, what is this guy talking about? But Cuss was building his confidence up. And that's what Lorne used to always do to me. He wouldn't talk to me, but sometimes he would give me a wink.
He wouldn't talk to you?
Build my confidence up. And I do, I would go out there and I'd do anything to make Lorne Michaels laugh. And it was a confidence builder for me. And I love Lorne for that.
You just said he wouldn't talk to you. Is that because he's not a talkative guy?
No, he was like Vince Lombardi. But he'd give you a wink. He'd give you a wink. Pat you on the butt. Yeah, good job. Good funny sketch. Give you a wink. He won't come over to you if he don't know you. If you're a new cast member, go, you were great, you were great. Because it might go to your head. But if he give you a wink, then you know you did your thing. But you still got Monday, brother. And you got to come even harder now.
Okay, so we have to hear that sketch that I was talking about before, The Black is the New President. So here's my guest, Tracy Morgan, at the Weekend Update desk.
Why is it that every time a black man in this country gets too good at something, there's always someone to come around and remind us that he's black? First Tiger, then Donovan McNabb, then me. Now Barack. I got a theory about that. It's a little complicated, but basically goes like this. We are a racist country, the end. Maybe not the people in this room, but if we're not a racist country, how did Hillary convince everybody in Texas and Ohio that Barack didn't know how to answer the phone at 3 a.m? Let me tell you something. Barack knows how to answer that phone. He's not gonna answer it like, hello, I'm scared. What's going on? He's gonna answer like, I would get a phone call at 3 a.m. Yeah, who's this?
This better be good. I'm gonna come down there and put somebody in a wheelchair. Some things just never change, Seth.
Okay.
People are saying he's not a fighter. Let me tell you something. He's a gangster. He's from Chicago. Barack is not just winning because he's a black man. If that was the case, I would be winning. And I'm way blacker than him. I used to smoke Newports and drink Old English. I grew up on government cheese. I prefer it.
So Tracy Morgan, tell us about how that sketch came to be. Did Tina Fey write the sketch?
Yeah, we both wrote it. We both collaborated on it.
Okay, so you've kind of needed a tissue a couple of times during the interview because you got very emotionally involved in telling us about some of the hardships that you faced.
Right.
There was an episode, I think, of 30 Rock where you went to your high school and kind of broke down. And I'm wondering, like, among people who know you, do they know you as somebody who, although you're famous for being funny, that beneath the surface, like, you're really emotional?
Yeah, I'm quite sure. So I have my emotional side. I don't show it publicly all the time because it's nobody's business. I'm open with you because we're talking. I'm going to give you what you give me. I'm going to keep it just as real as you keep it with me. This is not going to be 70-30. This is going to be 50-50, straight down the middle.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And I wish you good luck with
everything. I wasn't too crazy with it.
Tracy Morgan recorded in October after the publication of his memoir, I Am the New Black. Our series of memorable interviews from 2009 continues through this holiday week. We had planned to rebroadcast our interview with songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut today. He died of an overdose of muscle relaxants on Christmas Day. We've postponed the rebroadcast to give us time to speak with some of his friends and fellow musicians so that we can make the show more of a memorial. We expect to feature that sometime next week. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.